This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. The United States is expelling 10 Russian diplomats and imposing sanctions against dozens of companies and people for Russia's interference in last year's election and the hacking of several government agencies. Speaking at the White House, President Joe Biden said that he had told Russia's President Vladimir Putin that the sanctions could have been worse. Biden said he chose to be proportionate. He added that the United States is not looking to kick off a cycle of escalation and conflict with Russia, and that the United States wants a stable, predictable relationship. The sanctions are certain to exacerbate tensions with Russia, which promised a response, even as some experts said the measures appeared tailored to avoid an out-of-control escalation of retaliatory acts between the two countries. Daily infections of COVID-19 crossed 200,000 in India Thursday, making it the highest anywhere in the world. After imposing one of the world's strictest lockdowns for nearly 3 months last year, India's government relaxed almost all curbs by the beginning of 2021. Now many regions, including Mumbai, are introducing localized restrictions. The government has banned a widespread failure to practice social distancing and wear face masks, or rather blamed. Experts have blamed everything from official complacency to aggressive variants. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that the death toll in the United States has increased significantly in the past year, with more than 600,000 COVID-19 deaths being a major cause of the increase. Via remote, this is VOA News. The United Nations on Thursday released $1 million from its emergency fund to provide aid to the Caribbean nation of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, following a series of devastating volcanic eruptions. The UN spokesman said the funds will provide for urgent humanitarian assistance to impacted people, especially those who have been evacuated. About 20,000 people were evacuated from the vicinity of the La Sofria volcano in St. Vincent, which began erupting last Friday for the first time since 1979. About 4,500 people are in shelters, and the country's airspace is closed. Eruptions have continued to occur daily, with ash clouds covering the country and reaching surrounding islands. Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence is recovering from surgery after having a pacemaker implanted. His office said that Wednesday's operation in the nearby state of Virginia went well and that Pence is expected to fully recover and return to normal activities in the coming days. The 61-year-old's office said he experienced symptoms over the past 2 weeks that are associated with a slow heart rate. Pence is considered a likely 2024 presidential candidate if President Donald Trump declines to run. The United Nations humanitarian chief warned Thursday that an already dire situation in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region is getting worse 5 months into the conflict, with hunger, sexual violence rising, and no sign of the Eritrean troops' withdrawal. Mark Lowcock told a closed-door meeting of the UN Security Council that his office is starting to receive reports of people starving to death, according to a copy of his remarks seen by VOA. Despite obstacles and danger, humanitarians have been able to reach more than 1.7 million with some form of emergency assistance. Next week, the UN will appeal for $1.5 billion to assist 16 million people in Ethiopia this year. On March 26th, the Ethiopian Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, said Eritrea had agreed to withdraw its forces from Tigray, but Lowcock told the council members there is no evidence this has happened. And senior royals will wear civilian clothes to Prince Philip's funeral on Saturday, diffusing potential tensions over who would be allowed to don military uniforms. He died last week at the age of 99. For more news, join us at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 16, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Amnesty International calls for an investigation into alleged Eritrean troops attack on a town in Ethiopia's Tigray region.
Eritrean soldiers on the back of two trucks were crossing some town on the morning of 12 April. And as they approached one of the most populated areas of the town, they started shooting at the people who were going about their business.
Major South African cities are facing the threat of land invasion. Rights groups say abuses of LGBTQ people are on the rise in Cameroon. Greenpeace accuses Deutsche Bank of violating its own environmental and social policy. And Zambia's main opposition UPND's 48-hour ultimatum to the ruling party is up today, Friday.
We have to hold the ruling party accountable to the processes that have been stipulated by the Constitution of the Republic of Zambia.
And the WHO proposes raising taxes on tobacco products to save lives. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Amnesty International is calling for an independent investigation into eyewitness accounts of an attack by Eritrean troops on Adwa, a town in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Monday's shooting at a bus station left three people dead and 19 injured. The human rights group says it is ready to investigate or partner with other organizations to carry out the inquiry into the incident, as well as reports of other gross human rights violations during the ongoing conflict in Tigray. In a press statement, Amnesty International says eyewitnesses confirmed that Eritrean troops on the back of two military vehicles shot at the unarmed civilians without provocation. For more on the call for an independent international investigation, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Fiseha Tikle, Amnesty International researcher for Ethiopia.
Eritrean soldiers on the back of two trucks were crossing Aksum town on the morning of 12 April. And as they approached one of the most populated contested areas of the town, they started shooting at the people who were going about their business early in the morning, and that had left at least three people dead and 19 people wounded. And we spoke to witnesses who were on the spot at the time when this shooting has happened, and this is not the first time that has happened when Eritreans were killing or targeting civilians. So what we are calling now is that this kind of unprovoked attack on civilians should stop and should not continue.
Fisari, but some people are suggesting that perhaps the Eritrean soldiers might have been provoked by the civilians. So how do you respond to that?
Well, according to the witnesses we spoke to, there was no provocation. And it's in the middle of the city. And the only thing that happened in the morning was that there were rickshaws which are blocking the road, not blocking, but going around their business. So the shooting had started immediately afterwards. The first truck asked the rickshaws to clear off the road. And immediately it was followed by shooting. So we cannot call traffic congestion as provocation, justifying killing of civilians.
Some people are calling for international investigations. Is that the stance of Amnesty International as well?
There should be international investigation. And this is the latest of civilian casualties in the context of the ongoing conflict in Tigray. As you might remember, in February, we documented hundreds of people were killed, many of them civilians, in a raid in Aksum City. And similarly, this killing in Adwa has happened, and we are getting that there are so many civilian killings happening. So given that situation, there should be an independent international investigation to establish the extent and magnitude of the human rights violations. Some of them might amount to crimes against humanity.
Will Amnesty International be willing to join other international and local bodies as part of an independent investigative team to investigate this?
Amnesty International is keen to join an investigation. And as we have proved it many times since the start of the conflict, we have asked for access to go to Tigray and do investigation, which was not yet responded by the Ethiopian officials. So whenever there is a possibility of doing on-ground investigation, we are ready to do that separately or jointly with other organizations.
Fiseha Tikle is Amnesty International researcher for Ethiopia. He is speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Earlier this week, Zambia's main opposition, the United Party for National Development, UPND, gave the ruling Patriotic Front, PF Party, 48 hours to reconvene its convention held April 10 and 11 because the UPND says the convention did not comply with Zambia's constitution. UPND spokesperson Cornelius Mwitwa says that if the ruling party does not comply, UPND would ask the Supreme Court to block the PF from fielding candidates in the upcoming election. Zambia votes in presidential election on August 12 this year. President Edgar Lungu and members of the ruling party's central committee were chosen unopposed at this year's convention. The UPND ultimatum also comes as longtime UPND spokesperson Charles Kakoma defected to the ruling party. Mwitwa says President Lungu and the ruling PF must abide by the constitution.
We have to hold the ruling party accountable to the processes that have been stipulated by the Constitution. The Constitution of the Republic of Zambia, in terms of Article 62, provides that before a political party can participate in the general elections, they must hold intra-party elections so that those leaders in that particular political party do have a mandate from their supporters. Now, the Patriotic Front called for a convention for that particular purpose of electioneering in terms of intra-party elections, which was last Sunday. And at that convention, there was no vote that was held. As you would imagine, a convention entails elections. Elections entail voting. Voting entails ballots being cast and counted. Nothing in that equation of what I have said actually happened. It was a sham.
Of course, you have given 48 hours for the ruling Patriotic Front Party to reconvene its convention. So how likely that the party or the Zambian court will listen to your demand?
Well, the beauty about this is that this is not necessarily to comply with our demand, because our demand is anchored in the Constitution that you must hold a convention. So this is a legal requirement and not necessarily a political demand from us. It is conscripted in the Constitution.
What do you say to those Zambians who say that this effort is a waste of time and precious campaign money? They argue that perhaps the party should be addressing more pressing issues like food on the table.
It is ourselves as UPND who have been asking the Patriotic Front that this time round we have reached at a stage where now our political argument should be about policy and not politics. Hence our call to them that let's talk about food on the table. Let's talk about job creation with many young people having graduated from tertiary institutions. There are no jobs. The collapse of the kwacha against major trading currencies. Shopping malls, they are closing up. Zambia has never reached this low ebb. It is for the very first time. And we believe that time has come that the people of Zambia will make a big statement on 12 August 2021.
Mwitwa, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm available anytime.
Cornelius Mwitwa is the spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. Major South African cities are facing the threat of land invasion as people become more desperate to get free houses due to COVID-19 economic challenges. Use of tear gas and stun grenades by police in Cape Town, Johannesburg, and Pretoria has become more frequent to prevent angry crowds of people from occupying any available vacant land. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The hunger for land is growing and South African cities are not coping. Police have had their hands full in recent months as citizens demand a piece of land. The invaders are people largely staying in informal settlements around the cities and those who can no longer afford to pay rent. In the coastal city of Cape Town alone, 1,025 incidents of land invasions were recorded since March last year. Authorities say these invasions have cost the city over $8 million. In Rubberidge, a township south of Johannesburg, hundreds of people decided to erect tin houses on vacant land. They argue that the land belongs to the government and is their right to occupy it and build houses they so desperately need. But the government says it is private land. Sizwe Shange is one of the residents who have inverted the piece of land in Rubberidge.
We're fighting for this land. This land has been here for 40 years, and it hasn't been barricaded. And you can't claim and say that the land belongs to me if you don't say no trespassers, and it should be barricaded to show that it is belongs to someone else.
Police have to use rubber bullets and stun grenades to get the people off the land. However, in retaliation, they are constantly barricading roads with stones and burning tires, vowing to occupy the land at whatever cost. Land cartels are also taking advantage of the desperation for houses and making nice profits in the process. In the area of Vlaagfontein, also in Johannesburg, a land baron has grabbed private land earmarked for a $1 million housing project and started selling it to desperate house seekers. The landowner, who did not want his identity revealed, says shacks and brick and mortar houses have been erected, leaving them clueless on what to do.
There's a gentleman selling our properties out to people and claiming the land belongs to him, threatening us that they'll burn us down if we interfere and we will never get a land and the land belongs to him. And we're getting no help from the government or the police force in Didier even to get rid of the guy.
The capital, Pretoria, has not been spared. Up to 300 people have invaded vacant land east of the city and erected informal structures. A Thekwini municipality spokesperson, Msawake Maisela, says the tourist-preferred city of Durban has not been spared.
There are instances whereby land is invaded in areas that are not suitable for human settlements. When the disaster strikes, we are expected as the city to come to the rescue of the people that have invaded land.
But Nomsa Suzanne, from Abahlalibem Jondolo, an organization fighting for those living in informal settlements in cities to be given land to build proper houses, says access to land cannot be limited to those who can afford to buy it.
People should occupy the places. They should not be evicted.
It's now over 25 years since South Africa ended apartheid, but a vast percent of its land remains in the hands of the minority whites. Attempts to redistribute it has been met with legal interdicts. A bill to expropriate land without compensation is now in parliament. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 16. Rights activists and lawyers say hostility is increasing against the LGBT community in Cameroon, where same-sex relations are criminalized. Human Rights Watch says since February, Cameroon's security forces have detained, beaten, or threatened at least 25 people for homosexuality. The report comes as two detained transgender women, one a local social media celebrity, face up to 5 years in prison for wearing women's clothing in public. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Human Rights Watch says in a report this week that LGBTQ people are suffering a fresh wave of persecution in Cameroon, where same-sex relations are illegal. The group says in February, police detained 12 youths in the eastern town of Betwa for homosexuality, beat them and locked them in a police station. They were released the same day without charge. In the western town of Bafusam, the rights group says police detained 13 people, including 7 staff of Colibri, a group that provides HIV prevention and treatment. Colibri says police beat at least 3 of them and forced one of them to undergo a humiliating anal examination before they were also released. Human Rights Watch's Central Africa researcher Ilaria Alegrose says Cameroonian police often target sexual minorities for abuse.
We documented how the police and the gendarmes arrested, beat, threatened, humiliated LGBT people and subjected some of them to intrusive, humiliating anal exams, which are of no scientific value whatsoever, but have been unfortunately and regularly carried out to prosecute LGBT people.
The rights group's report indicates Cameroon's police tend to target public gatherings of LGBTQ people, even small ones. It comes as 2 transgender women, one a social media celebrity, face up to 5 years in prison when they appear in the Cameroon court on April 26. Douala police detained Loic Njekam, known as Shakiro, and Roland Moose in February for wearing women's clothing while eating at a restaurant. They pleaded not guilty to a charge of attempted homosexuality. Tamfu Richard is one of their lawyers.
The Cameroonian Penal Code is very severe on same-sex orientations. That is why you see LGBT persons in Cameroon face these abuses of their right, and they have to be in hiding for fear of being faced with the repression of the justice system. The tracking of LGBT persons is on the rise. A lot of people have been dragged before the court over offenses of homosexuality and public indecency.
Richard says targeting of LGBTQ people in Cameroon intensified after neighboring Gabon last year legalized same-sex relations. Cameroon police and officials declined to comment when asked about the increasing attacks on LGBT kids. Despite slow acceptance in parts of the continent, many Africans see homosexuality as a foreign Western import. Homosexual sex is illegal in more than half of sub-Saharan African countries. But activists like Human Rights Watch's Alegrozi point out that being an LGBTQ person is not.
We ask the government to decriminalize same-sex conduct and repeal the law, which currently not only violates the Cameroonian constitution, but also international law.
3 Cameroonian lawmakers contacted declined to comment, citing fear of official reprisal for discussing the sensitive issue. Human Rights Watch said it shared its findings with Cameroon's government in a March 25 letter and requested answers to specific questions. Cameroonian officials have yet to respond. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The World Health Organization says that raising taxes on cigarettes and other tobacco products is the smartest and best way to save lives and save billions of dollars in health expenditures. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An estimated 8 million people die prematurely every year from tobacco-related illnesses such as emphysema and lung cancer. Furthermore, the World Health Organization reports the cost of smoking to the global economy comes to more than $1.4 trillion in health expenditures and lost productivity. The WHO has issued a new manual on tobacco taxes to inform policymakers and others on how to create and implement the strongest tobacco taxation policies for their specific countries. Jeremiah St. Paul Jr. is head of fiscal policies and health promotion for the WHO. He says scare tactics employed by the tobacco industry are a key hindrance to raising taxes. He urges governments not to be put off by ploys aimed at undermining tobacco reforms, such as...
If you increase tobacco taxes, you increase smuggling and illicit trade, you're sued in the court. Raising tobacco taxes is anti-poor. If you increase tobacco taxes, revenues will go down and employment impact will be negative.
Paul says the new WHO manual documents countries that address these scare tactics and succeeded in raising resources through good tax administration. For example, he says the Philippines has increased its revenue and tripled its health budget by taxing tobacco.
If you raise tobacco taxes, it does more to prevent premature deaths from non-communicable diseases than any other single health intervention. If you just increase taxes by $1, you can raise about $200 billion of additional revenues.
According to the WHO, in 2018, only 38 countries, covering 14% of the global population, had sufficiently high tobacco taxes, which the agency defines as 75% of the retail price of a pack of cigarettes. When it comes to taxes, Paul says, the rule of thumb is to make sure they are high enough to make tobacco products less affordable and deter consumers from using them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the news that double Olympic 800 meters champion Caster Semenya moved closer to qualifying for the 2020 Tokyo Games in a new event after defending her South African Championships 5,000 meters title in Pretoria on Thursday. Caster Semenya trimmed nearly 15 seconds off her personal best by crossing the line in 15 minutes 52.28 seconds, which was 42.28 seconds outside the Tokyo qualifying time of 15 minutes 10 seconds. The race was staged at an altitude of 1,339 meters, and Semenya is considering running the same distance at sea level, where the air is less thin and times generally faster. In neighboring Namibia, about 200 athletes are expected to compete at the Senior Track and Field Championships slated for Saturday and Sunday at the Independence Stadium in the capital. Athletics Namibia will host the event, and some prominent athletes such as sprinters Beatrice Masilingi and Christine Mboma will be in action. Athletes with disabilities will also compete against one another, and Athletics Namibia President Erwin Naimwaka says the event serves as a qualification event to the highly anticipated 2021 Tokyo Olympics in July. In volleyball news, the 2021 Confederation of African Volleyball Men's African Volleyball Club Championships is set to begin this weekend in the North African nation of Tunisia. The event will mark the 40th edition of the championship, with clubs from across Africa expected to attend the 10-day tournament, with competing teams strengthening training in preparations for the tournament. The event serves us from April 16th to 28th. In Sousse, Tunisia, the Men's African Volleyball Clubs Championship is the most prestigious volleyball competition for clubs in Africa, organized by the CAVB since 1980s. In football news, Gabon international and Arsenal forward Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang has been treated in hospital after he contracted malaria while on international duty with Gabon. The 31-year-old scored in Gabon's 3-0 win over DR Congo in African Cup of Nations qualification on the 25th of March. He played in Arsenal's Europa League quarterfinals first leg against Slavia Prague on April the 8th, but missed Sunday's win over Sheffield United. Writing on his official Instagram page, Aubameyang said he had to spend a few days in hospital this week. Staying with more football news, Claude Leroy has resigned as coach of Togo after they failed to qualify for the African Cup of Nations finals, but said he was far from finished in African football. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson
O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, April 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.